All right, so let's get started. Thank you everyone for joining this partner session, taking part as part of the OECD annual forum on minerals. This is hosted by XAPA, and first and foremost, I will share a few online meeting instructions for all participants joining us as we speak. So by default, people are muted, and if you want to take part in the conversation, you are welcome to raise hand or use the chat function to share any type of question that you might have. And as being the moderator myself, I'll make sure to take them into account. By default, we prefer people to turn off cameras, so maximize a little bit some of the energy consumption and footprint of that discussion. You can share with other participants. And for social media, you can tag at xapa.org and OECD for if you're willing to share any comment or reaction that you might have. By the very last 20% of the discussion, we will launch a very small poll, three questions. Please respond to these three questions. It's helpful to kind of navigate and ensure the quality of those series of discussions that we're trying to host on a regular basis. I am the moderator today. I'm Farid Badash. I lead an organization called XAPA. Been working notably on minerals and conflict minerals for more than 10, 15 years, and more broadly on human rights and supply chain for about 20-ish years. And I'm very delighted to have been part and remain part of those very challenging and interesting conversations, because I think today it's very timely to explore particularly the role of investors in the question of forced labor, as technologies, regulations, practices are improving quite significantly, particularly across the past, let's say, 5, 10 years. So I'm looking forward to the conversation. A very brief word about our organization. I think it's always helpful for participants to know basically the host and basically the perspective that it might bring to the discussion. So in a nutshell, XAPA.org is a nonprofit organization that has been developed a couple of years ago to set up solutions that help to proactively bring solutions to human rights across a broad value chain and supply chain. So we do that through different activities, including consulting, where we work on due diligence, development of policies and tools, engagement of suppliers and value chain. We deploy some programs, multi-year programs on the ground, engaging workers, smallholder farmers, to improve livelihoods and work on multiple human rights issues that can be at stake across those global value chains. And we expand those programs with the design and deployment of funds that can help to expand the reach and the number of beneficiaries of those programs. And last, but I think that's important, we are an organization that work with a strong advocacy agenda, meaning that we produce on a regular basis a lot of content around human rights that is accessible for free on our website. We have a number of clients. It's mostly multinational companies, academia, and multilateral institutions. We work actually also closely a lot with financial institutions, hence the discussion today, where we are very, very happy to focus particularly on the particular role that can be fairly sensitive, but so critical, that can be that of investors in the questions of advancing human rights across operations and value chains of multinational, I would say, companies and multinational and global economies. We operate across the globe. So when we talk about forced labor for today, I think it's an important aspect. Although obviously, and I'll be part of the conversation, there are a lot of concerns related to China. But we think that the topic and every topic has to be addressed across a much broader lens. So we explore notably today the concept of forced labor across its multitudes of potential likelihood and occurrences across the globe. That could be the case within the European Union, within the US, Pacific Asian markets, and obviously China. I'm sure our panelists will have some words about China. So these are some sample content that we produce every month. 4,000 plus decision makers are engaging and using and access those contents, particularly across Europe, Asia, and Pacific Asia. So now let's get into the core of the discussion. So I took time to make that brief introduction because I think it's a way for participants to understand that we are practitioners people, really like working on those issues across the globe and trying really to find some concrete solutions. So I'm looking forward to a conversation where we can make that conversation as concrete as possible for everyone to have some very clear and great takeaways. And I thought I would start getting into the core of the discussion with a few updates on something very recent and a number that is not, unfortunately, that recent. The number that I wanted to bring to the attention of everyone here is, according to ILO, we can consider that about 25 million workers globally against or at risk to suffer from forced labor. 25 million, it's not nothing. It's massive. Overnight, from the webinar that we can hear today, there was some media coverage, notably on the New York Times and in the BBC that are just displayed on the screen about the car industry caught in some allegations of forced labor importing from China components of vehicles. So I thought I would start the conversation and kick off with this very, very recent headline because it means that although there have been a lot of documentations, reports, pinpointing risks of forced labor from years, overnight, as you can see, it's still something that remained potentially, because it's allegations with media coverage, potentially something that has to be at top of mind for a lot of manufacturing technology and consumer good companies first, meaning that by implication, it must be top of mind for investors and financial partners of companies, of financial vehicles that help to develop produce that can take part, for example, in the support of green transition in a broad sense. And I say that when you look in the middle with the fact that because of the geopolitical context, there is growing shift of operations from China, outside China. And for us, it's been always important to look at that with vigilance because we know that it's not because manufacturing might shift from China to outside China, and notably on some green technology components, that the risk of forced labor may not necessarily remain valid. There have been a lot of reported cases related to Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, Gulf region, Indonesia, and I can keep going on and on. That means that whenever a financial partner is exploring the way a company is evolving or investing to shift potentially or conduct additional investments in or outside China related to green technologies, this question of forced labor remains very valid. Last point, regulations. All of you are definitely aware of the US making efforts to combat Uyghur related production and import in the US, which has been seconded or expanded, I should say, with a much more recent EU regulation banning import of forced labor in a much broader sense than that, with a focus on the Uyghur question and Xinjiang geographical location in the EU single market. So, all that in a context where, and that will be my last point, the EU is very actively exploring the concept of green taxonomy and Green Deal, encouraging to shift investments to support green transition in a broad sense. And this, with the last but very important little bullet point, which basically is expected to happen without doing harm, no significant harm principle, asking again, financial partners or investors to explore very closely the evolution of those green transitions and related investments in respect of human rights in a broad sense and forced labor in particular. So the topic is fairly complex. The geopolitical landscape makes it even more sensitive. Everyone is looking at those issues with high attention because if we step back a minute, it's all about trying to advance green transition. It's all about developing renewables. It's all about ensuring that we decarbonize the world. But it's all about making sure that this happens in a way that does not infringe human rights and substitute problems for other problems. And to address these questions, luckily, I am supported or benefit from the great contribution of a list of impressive panelists who will introduce themselves in a minute. But again, I want to thank the OECD Forum on Responsible Mineral Supply Chains to host this partner session as part of its broader agenda. And I encourage all of you to look more closely at this agenda and to pick and choose and obviously attend multiple of those sessions, which hopefully will bring to all participants access to great concrete guidance to improve practices. Moving on, I will encourage my panelists to introduce themselves briefly. So maybe let's start in order as it's displayed on the screen with Abigail Roper. Welcome.
Great. Thank you so much. Can you hear me? Okay.
Very well.
Wonderful. Well, good morning. It's good morning here. I'm in Washington. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate, and thank you for that helpful introduction. For those of you I have not met yet, my name is Abigail Ross Hopper. I am the president and CEO of SEIA, the Solar Energy Industries Association. We are the national trade association for the solar and storage industry here in the United States. While our sort of policy focus is on US and state level policies, obviously there's lots of international engagement, particularly around the issue of forced labor. We've been doing a lot, and I'm excited to talk about it. But just to give you a flavor of who we represent companies, only companies. We represent companies throughout the solar and storage supply chain, from manufacturers to developers to bankers. We represent all parts of the solar marketplace. So on your home to large projects in the desert. And we have everything from like a two-person small business to many publicly traded companies. So as well as lots of international companies headquartered here with operations overseas or headquartered overseas with operations here. So quite a variety of companies that we work with. Thanks again for having me.
Thank you very much. Remy, maybe a brief word about yourself and your organization.
Great. Thanks, Farid. And thank you, Chris, as well for having me on the support webinar and also for really sort of setting the scene. And I think this really sort of marks the importance of what we're discussing today. So just by means of brief introduction, my name is Remy Fernandez. I oversee human rights, social, and governance issues at the Principles for Responsible Investment, or the PRI. And so just for brief context, the PRI is the world's leading proponent of responsible investment. So it works to understand the investment implications of environmental, social, and governance factors. And so this is in order to support its international network of over 5,000 investor signatories in incorporating these factors into their investment and ownership decisions. Thank you. Back over to you, Farid.
And you've been growing very fast for the past decade or something. So it shows that there is a growing interest for being responsible as an investor. Fabrice.
Hello, I'm Fabrice Warneck. I'm monitoring director of Electronics Watch. We are a nonprofit organization, and our objective is to support workers into the supply chains to defend their rights, as simple as that. And it's not easy, of course, the supply chains are quite long. To do this, we have affiliated 1,500 public buyers who are mainly in Europe, but also now in Australia, we have the University of Sydney. Most of the public buyers are the cities like City of Barcelona, so Oslo, also big organizations like the Transport of London. And these public buyers are, of course, interested in making sure that their supply chain is clean. So we're interested in this cooperation with them because they have the leverage, of course, towards the brands that they buy computers, they buy electric buses, and they have the economic leverage towards the brands and the resellers. And the brands, of course, have the leverage towards the factories and the mines. So we try to work this way also in a chain. We also work with a Responsible Business Alliance, which is a big organization for the industry of electronics. And we have monitoring partners in 14 countries. So we work with a network of local NGOs who go investigate working conditions in factories and mines. That's it. And I will be in Paris today and tomorrow and the day after if you want to know more about our activities.
And then people can feel free to send you a direct message during this webinar to find a way to meet with you while you're at this attending the forum. Jeanette, maybe a word about yourself and Meridiam.
Yes, well, good morning or good afternoon, everyone. And as for the other, thank you for inviting me to join this panel. My name is Jeanette Borza. I'm head of ESG and sustainability at Meridiam, and I've been so for 8 years now. Meridiam is a private investment fund that is specializing in long-term investment in public infrastructure. Long-term for us is an investment of more than 20 years. So just as an example, since 2005, when Meridiam was created, since then we haven't exited one asset yet. So that's a good example of how committed Meridiam is in making sure that every investment is really resilient and sustainable. And we focus on three main sectors, which are sustainable mobility, social infrastructure, such as hospitals, schools, and the sorts, and on energy transition as well. So, of course, the human rights risk associated with our investments are at the heart of our preoccupations, such as the biodiversity, the work conditions in general, but making sure that we develop infrastructure that will be well embedded in their environment. But when we first started looking at how our investment would be affected eventually by human rights risks and, in particular forced labor, it was a bit challenging because, of course, we may be in a process that will that will include procuring a lot of materials throughout the value chain. And of course, making a lot of different organizations work for each project that we develop. Because we invest a lot in greenfield projects and we actually even become project sponsors. Very close to the project sites, developing not only investing but developing, building and operating assets for a very long time. That means that we need to have a good understanding of the different risks that we'll be facing throughout the life of an asset in our portfolio. So for that reason we. We have developed different mechanisms and procedures internally, it's also why today I guess we're in contact with XEPA and the different initiatives that were launched recently with them. So happy to discuss these issues in the next few minutes.
Thank you, Jeanette. And Christelle, now you might introduce yourself as well. You've been
thank you.
Thank you. The conversation, so.
Thank you. So my name is Christelle Basile. As mentioned by my colleague, I'm part of XEPA. I work alongside other colleagues on questions related to business and human rights, and happy to join the conversation.
And we thought that to kind of get started with the conversation because people want concrete takeaways from those discussions. So getting started with one, Christelle, I think you've been at the forefront of the production of a toolkit OL 2023 onward. Maybe you can explain what it is, and just in case participants are interested, then they might come to you and ask for it.
Of course. So last year, XEPA launched really in response to our clients and industry demand for more guidance on how to tackle the upcoming regulations on forced labor. However, this led us to more of an in-depth conversation, and we decided to not take it from a sort of how to be legally compliant in terms of how to respond to the regulation, but really think about the problems, the problem itself, and how to tackle it from the outset. So the green transition free from forced labor, or the GT3 FLI, like we like to call it, was launched last year. It brought together a group of founding members of both European and American companies and investors that are active in the green and just transition sector, including Meridiam we have today. And this initiative was also, so we developed a toolkit that was meant to really guide in this initial step of understanding why forced labor is very likely to occur in the green transition, why is it a salient risk, and how to address it, whether as a buyer, from a buyer's perspective, or from an investor's perspective. With the toolkit was developed really by conducting desktop research and information. We focused the last year's initiative on solar panels and some of the battery components related to solar panels and its value chain. So it was partly desktop research, but it was also built on the contribution of these founding members. So very much the challenges faced by buyers and investors in the space, but it was also developed afterwards. We did a round of stakeholder engagement, including with some of the members we have on the panel today. So UNPRI, Remy, and Electronic Watch were very much part of this discussion in providing us feedback from their perspective on what they also see as challenges on the ground. So just to show, give you a snippet of some of the challenges we came back with after working on this question last year, which were faced by both buyers and investors, was the question of time. So on the one hand, there is this time increased pressure to invest and develop renewable energy in a timely manner. We have 2025 agendas, 2030 agendas, 2050 agendas, and targets and things we need to reach and goals we need to reach in the near future, really. And this urgency to go through it. Because of the climate crisis, obviously nobody's denying that. However, on the other hand, we're not really making the appropriate steps that should accompany this urgent need to go into the green transition while making it just. So, for example, many of the challenges we had is that, okay, the very restrictive legal frameworks and import bans that are not coming in, we should also think about the side effects and the consequences of these import bans. So we have a blog on this, and we can share it with the audience and after this conversation. But we noticed that at part of these import bans, many loopholes in the legislations were taking place. So we found that while the EU market and now the US market, and obviously Abby will tell us more later, became a no-go zone for any products that are produced by forced labor, we found that other markets became dumping grounds, for example. So what about this? That we didn't solve the issue of forced labor when we create these import bans. For example, so are we really solving the root cause with these legislations? We also noticed that some products that were issued from certain regions were then moved to other regions, repackaged, and then the traceability was diluted, and then therefore was able to come into market from another door, basically. So this is some of the challenges we're hoping maybe in this conversation also part of the participants can share their insights on that. But also, from another perspective, we found that many were really embedding human rights clauses into their contracts, supplier codes of conduct and saying, okay, great, we've tried, we're deploying this, what do we do next? It's bigger than us, the problem is bigger than us, it's a governmental issue, it's political, this is the role we can play, and then what? So again, many of these issues are still on the table, and hopefully we get to discuss them later today. So in the toolkit, we were like, faced with all these issues. We were like, okay, we're going to take a step back and we're going to go back to the root cause and say, let's go back to best practice and say, how do we address it really step by step? And this is where we turn back to the OECD responsible business conduct on due diligence, and specifically on the guidance on mining of these minerals, which really leads to then the manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera. So really go back to the root cause and say, okay, step one of the OECD, step two of the OECD. And we provided detailed information for every step of the way on how to implement the guidance into companies' operation and business and investors' operation. So I'm sure the audience, and I mean, we're in an OECD forum. There is no need to bore you with the OECD five steps. I'm sure everybody is aware of that. However, what we tried to also develop was a red flag. So we wanted to be operational based on the group's demand also in the initiative to say, okay, we need something practical. We're doing deals, we're reviewing contracts. We need something easier to set up internally. And we created sort of a red flag on forced labor based on many research that's out there. And we included the sources, obviously, in the toolkit on how to detect forced labor on a sector level, on a country level, and then on a business operations level. And we sort of helped guide on how to assess the answers of these red flags. And then in turn, how to engage with certain suppliers, whether they're high risk, medium risk, or low risk. So part of the feedback was also... Part of the feedback, which is also included, obviously, in the OECD five steps, is how do you establish a strategy then? Once you've detected this red flag, what strategy you need to adopt in order to address these issues once you've detected them? So it's important. So one of our stakeholders shared with us that it's important to distinguish between state-imposed forced labor and forced labor imposed by private actors and individuals. So Ed Ferries mentioned, there is China and the whole Uyghur situation, but it's important to qualify this as state-imposed forced labor. And this in itself imposes a specific strategy to address. So this entails, for example, the importance of having collaborative initiatives on an industry level with other players, with other partners, and including governments, because indeed it is very political. However, if it's a business model of a certain company pushing in order to produce microchips in a record time, then this is a private actor that is really that has caused forced labor because of its business model, and this should be tackled from another perspective. So in all this, we also give tips on the role of investors in this. What are the questions investors need to ask, and the importance of not just also turning to certifications and audits, because as we all know by now, they're useful, practical, but also insufficient. So it's also important to take all of this into account. Yeah, so in a nutshell, this was broadly what the toolkit looked like. Please feel free to reach out to us if you'd like to know more about this toolkit, and hopefully we get to discuss some of the burning points we still have on the table with our participants today. Thank you.
Thank you, Krista. I thought, Remy, in view of the 5,000 each signatories that basically are included in the PRIs, you could maybe kind of build upon Christelle's point and maybe some from your, you know, helicopter view, some of the challenges overall that might connect with what Christelle just said, or instead might, you know, differ, I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. And also, thank you, Christoph, for a really comprehensive outline of the toolkit. I think it's a really good step in terms of setting the foundation of, you know, how do you actually start beginning that identification process? And I think the points raised around where there are limits around trade bans and how that can cause trade diversion really reinforces the importance of investors in actually sort of tackling the issue of forced labor in the green transition. I think part of the challenge is just around the complexity of value chains linked to the green transition. So where investors are overseeing a diversified portfolio of companies, prioritization through human rights due diligence is really key. And so more broadly, thinking back to the steps identified by Christelle, assessing risks based on country and sector level, if you're dealing with a larger portfolio of companies, and then really seeing, you know, what are your salient human rights issues to prioritize in your risk assessment. Just something as well to stress is that the risk across the green transition should really be framed in terms of both the transition out of high carbon as well as the transition into green energy. And so thinking about the transition out, this really presents challenges in terms of stranded workers with limited opportunities for retraining or redeployment, so also placing them at a heightened risk of forced labor, as well as thinking about stranded communities through the phase out of mining and coal plant sites and also other sort of high fossil fuel or high carbon intensive sites. When we're thinking about the transition into green energy, forced labor risk can be identified through different sorts of mechanisms. So one of them being the remote location of renewable energy projects, where workers could face similar forced labor risks seen in other remote industries such as forestry, agriculture, and extractives. Acquisition of land for renewable energy sites can also lead to forced displacement of communities. And so this really heightens the risk of human trafficking and forced labor. And so I guess a similar parallel to draw from that would be similar to the forced migration as a result of climate change. And then, as you're all very aware, mining sites present their own unique challenges with regards to their track record on force and child labor, both be it within ASM or LSMs. And according to Walk Free, there are currently 35,000 children working in the cobalt industry in the DRC, just to give you sort of a snapshot of the gravity of the problem. And I think just to highlight as well that while the predominant focus has centered on the energy sector, the green transition transcends any single sector's boundaries. So from agriculture to manufacturing, transportation to finance, every sector has a role in enabling the green transition and present their own unique risks to forced labor. So really sort of, I think the final key point here is bringing in a really robust human rights due diligence process, so you're able to start that mapping and prioritization exercise.
Thank you very much. Very enlightening. I thought maybe Abigail, I'm curious particularly on maybe on the point made by Remy about the transition out as much as the transition in, because I suspect that a lot of your membership is kind of struggling in the middle of those transitions. So maybe that's just a way to kind of transition actually to your broader perspective on the challenges that investors might face that you can see through your membership.
Thank you. And thank you, Crystal, for that broad discussion of the toolkit. It's fascinating. And there are definitely some key challenges. Remy talked about some of them. I hadn't really thought about the transition from and the transition to before. So that's an interesting way to conceptualize it. And it's certainly, we are right in the middle of it here in the United States. I wanted to talk a little bit just to sort of set the framework of how we're thinking about these challenges. So Crystal made the point about kind of sort of industry practice or company practice. And I think what we're seeing in the solar supply chain and storage as well is probably a mix of both. Certainly, I'd be curious what Crystal has to say about that. But certainly, our government has focused on particular regions of the world, and in particular with regard to solar, the Xinjiang region of China. And so there was a piece of legislation passed maybe 2 years ago now, called the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, a national piece of legislation. And that that was a forcing mechanism, certainly, to get companies and suppliers to move quickly to evaluate their supply chains, because literally our borders closed felt like overnight. And so we had lots of product stuck at the ports, and you know, projects that had big trackers built and no solar panels yet. And so what are the challenges? Obviously, there's a lot of, as you said, lots of companies, lots of investors have either industry practice or their own ESG priorities, or their customer or their investors ESG priorities. But knowing, you know, the distance between where forced labor is happening and the end product is pretty significant. We don't manufacture a lot yet here in the United States. And so literally being able to understand what is happening thousands of miles away is really critical and really challenging. But so the other thing that's particularly challenging to investors, at least through our eyes, is kind of the visibility into the supply chain. I think I have certainly gotten a very, been on a very steep learning curve about the solar and storage supply chain. I know many of my companies are, and the investors are sort of at the last piece of that. So, you know, they certainly knew where the, probably where the trackers were coming from, where the panels were coming from, but not necessarily where the raw materials were being mined and what the situation was around that. And so it has been a real learning experience, and like kind of a, I don't even know how to say it, sort of a restructuring of entire supply chains as we have grappled with these. I would say the last issue or key challenge I would face is as a competitive one, right? I mean, you talked about, you know, if we close the borders in the United States and Europe, it's not that this practice isn't happening. It's just those products are going elsewhere. And, you know, how do we think about solving the problem and not just diverting the problem? But there's also is, I think, a competitive aspect, so that, you know, in the United States, it's more expensive to build solar than a lot of other places. And when we look at the companies that are multinational and they're looking about capital allocation, right, sometimes they'll decide, you know what, the U.S. has too many tariffs, too many border protections, too many regulations. We're just going to deploy elsewhere. That does not help our green transition, but it also kind of just provides bigger markets for some products that are being built with forced labor. And so this idea of a holistic approach and a collaborative model are really important, but I think those are a couple of the challenges we see investors facing as we grapple with this global issue.
Thank you. We'll come back to some of the initiative though made by CIA in response to those issues on traceability and others. I say that as well to kind of tease a little bit our participants for the next round of discussion. But in the meantime, I maybe Fabrice, just curious from your perspective in response or kind of looking at Abigail's perception on the visibility on the supply chain. You basically have people grounded in multiple geographies. So what's your view on that challenge? And maybe, of course, feel free to share additional challenges, visibility on the supply chain, to identify where forced labor might occur?
So it's a very interesting question. Thank you very much. I was in Congo some months ago, and I was visiting the mines in the artisanal small-scale mines of cobalt. And obviously there, it's like, middle age. There are no equipment, individual equipment, no individual protective equipment at all, no helmet, no boots, nothing. It's just hard to believe what you can see there. And very often there are people die in these mines. So yes, I would say the traceability is a great question, because in fact, the extraction of the large-scale mines and the one of the small mines that are artisanal are mixed together. And then they are exported to China for transformation in smelters. So, okay, maybe in the large scale mines, it's quite okay, better. I'm not saying it's okay, but in the small mines, it's not okay at all. And that's where 80% of the miners are working, okay? And these ores are mixed together. And in this artisanal mining, we find, of course, child labor. I have seen a lot of teenagers there trying to make some money. You know, the great impulse is poverty, of course. People are self-exploiting themselves. As I said, they have no knowledge at all about basic health and safety standards. Absolutely not. They are not trained. And they are not paid fairly. Why? Because the one who fixes the pay for the ore they bring back to the buyer is the one himself buying. So if you want, the one who buys has the machine to calculate, to analyze the ore and the minerals, and to say there is so much humidity into these minerals, there is so much ore, I will give you that much money. Okay, so there is no independency. So the miner is depending on the buyer, in fact. That's the, I would say, the great problem. But the cooperatives that exist are not real cooperatives in DRC. In fact, it's a couple of people who usually are close to the politicians, and the miners have no say. They just have the right to shut up. That's the main issue.
Thank you. We'll come back to potential solutions that can help. But prior to that, obviously, I think it's important to kind of close this first round of discussions with the perspective of a practitioner, Jeanette, who definitely has an opinion about where you're struggling, really, in view of what's been just said by all of the panelists.
Yes, and I'll come back to something Abigail just said about this context or this issue being or needing to be seen as with an holistic response or solution, because it's a system and it's extremely difficult to get out of this system or make the system evolve. And maybe I can take the analogy of you're on a road and you're driving your car, an electric car, of course, not a regular one. But you may be very, cautious and you will follow all the rules and the speed limits. But if all the drivers around you are driving recklessly, it's very difficult, to remain safe. And that's the problem with human rights in general and the risks associated with human rights, because you may want to do your best to procure with the right suppliers, making sure that your entire value chain is developed properly and responsibly. The issue is that the availability of not well procured components and materials will still remain unless everyone is on board, with a responsible conduct. So, for Meridiam, we're in a context of competition. Because when we want to develop an asset, we're never alone in the market. We will have to compete most likely with other groups, other investors, and that may drive recklessly. So it's very challenging to remain in compliance with your own commitments and own mission and own vision, and still do good and still develop these essential energy transition projects. So that's one of our challenges, And we'll talk about the procedures and how we manage these issues later. But this is one you know, one very important one. And we also, you know, maybe another, not a challenge as much as an opportunity, but you know, we see that that these issues of human rights risks and forced labor, for instance, being more and more put up front and described and highlighted, we see that it should be an opportunity to accelerate the development of other sources of materials and of components. But that means that you know, we have to be more demanding and to be part of the solution as a consumer, because you know, as an investor, you consume these materials and components because they're part of your investment and of your projects. So this is you know, kind of the reality that we face today at Meridiam.
Thank you. Very helpful. I think this partner session being hosted by the OECD as part of the forum, there is this question of the interaction with policymakers, definitely. OECD having this responsibility to build better policies for better lives. That's the motto, if I'm right. So at some point, you are all welcome, I guess, to connect the dots, which we can do in transition with the next round of questions on the role of investors. And I would, because I think it's important in those discussions that are fairly complex to clarify roles. But I would start maybe asking you, Abigail, a question, because listening to you, I clearly understand the challenge of competitiveness, kind of reshifting or rebuilding some kind of assets, notably in the US, which can be competitive. This is in view of the context, though, of maybe just two quick points that I can make, and other panelists are welcome to share their views on that as well. First, IRA, Inflation Reduction Act, is often perceived across the globe and as a definitive driver, encouraging strongly investors to invest in the US, which to some extent could kind of offset a little bit the challenges of competitiveness, but maybe I'm wrong, so happy to have your views on that. But actually, I would actually also connect that with another question for the role of investor that we've heard so many times. A challenge for investors is often that, you know, ultimately you're mandated, you have accountability on how you make sure to generate yield above certain thresholds. And the problem of shifting is maybe partly or mostly a question of competitiveness, but it's actually also a problem of mandate. And ultimately, why an investor should take the risk to invest in an emerging industry somewhere if elsewhere there is an industry that is very well established and very competitive with clear visibility on long-term cost and basically the yield that can be generated if capital is therefore invested rather than elsewhere. So I'm kind of phrasing here transitioning between challenges and the actual role of investors in all of that. To have your views, Abigail, on those points and beyond, obviously.
Yeah, no, those are all really good points. And you were right, the Inflation Reduction Act, or the IRA, as we all shorten it, that was passed in 2022, is a huge driver, right? I can share that between 2022 and 2023, the solar market in the United States increased by 53%, right? Can you imagine a marketplace increasing by that? Last week, we announced that we hit 5 million solar installations in the United States. We've had over 60 solar manufacturing companies announce either new facilities or expanded facilities here in the United States. And so there's certainly, it's a really fair point that the competitiveness is being offset a bit by the importance of the IRA. And, you know, to the extent that sort of why invest in this renewable technology, sort of new market I mean, I would say every single graph, every single chart, every single piece of data we have tells us that this market is growing, and it's growing rapidly. And, you know, there's a lot of policy that is mandating or encouraging some of this transition, but there's a lot of just economics that are moving it, especially here. You know, I don't pretend to be an expert on global policy, but I am an expert here in the United States. And so much of the demand of solar and storage and wind is based on price and not necessarily based on policy. So that we sort of made that shift a while ago, even with the passage of the IRA. The IRA certainly makes things more advantageous financially, but it doesn't require, right? And so that has been a really important driver. But sort of your question about the role of investors in tackling this, I think, you know, all the speakers are right, and I agree wholeheartedly about this systems approach. But one of the ways that we can continue to push the system, and I think investors play a huge role in this, is by investing in other places, right? Like, if we don't want just sending products made with forced labor to other countries, then we need to decrease the demand for them. And we do that by increasing the supply in places that do have ethical supply chains, places like the United States, Europe, and other places. But that requires an investment, right? So the IRA helps with that, but it's not all of it. We need investors who are willing to build not only in our country, but in other countries. I always use the phrase that have a similar ethics or similar, you know, an ethical supply chain. I think that's, that is, and development practices. So that's one thing I think the role of investors. I think the other thing is also not to just look at the actual manufacturing, but how do we create products that last longer? How do we create sustainable recycling programs? How do we think about extracting sort of the most valuable pieces at the end of life of these products, so that, again, there's less demand on the front side, thereby changing some of the economics. I'm a huge believer that companies are always going to act in what's in their best economic interest, right? And so we can wish things were different and hope they were different, but until we have some economic drivers, I'm less optimistic about the behavior of companies or humans, basically. So, you know, the IRA helps with that, putting money into these markets where the demand is growing like crazy and there's policy support, and then creating financeable options and, you know, good business models for how to monetize the recycling, how to monetize sort of extraction of the key materials once things come to the end of life is a challenge we're certainly tackling here, but I think is an opportunity for a lot more conversation.
Yeah, thank you. Very helpful maybe to help Remy build on those points that you're making, because I strongly suspect that PRIs have been thinking about the role of investors for some time, particularly in view of the application of the guiding principles and in view of some growing regulation. So maybe you could kind of confirm that your views are, you know, converging with Abigail's and or maybe slightly different.
Yeah, definitely. And I think just a nod to the IRA in terms of how it's sort of structured around incentivization. And it's looking at both sort of transition into renewable energy, but also the impacts on communities. And I think it's one of the first instruments we've seen that really marries that social aspect with the environmental aspect at the same time. And I think that's, a really good way to sort of see how this can be done through that more sort of economic incentivization. And just in terms of the application of the principles, our position paper on human rights just rearticulates that just as for all businesses, institutional investors have a responsibility to respect human rights as formalized by the UN and OECD, and that this responsibility is aligned with the United Nations guiding principles and the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises. And just as we're sort of seeing in terms of policy developments, we're seeing increased convergence around these frameworks, so notably as we've seen through the EU's Corporate Sustainability Due Diligence Directive, and this convergence is really creating that level playing field. But I think just sort of diving a little bit deeper into the green transition and sort of going into what the role is of investors, I really like Fabrice's point around touching on that element of traceability. And I think where you have the outputs from LSMs, it becomes very difficult and murky, because you'll have the outputs as well from artisanal scale mines sort of mixed in, and it makes that traceability just more complicated. We've published cobalt engagement guidance, which looks at both how to engage downstream and upstream companies. And so looking at sort of that downstream end, I think this is really thinking about, do they have a responsible sourcing policy or equivalent for minerals aligned with the OECD's due diligence guidance for responsible supply chains of minerals from conflict affected high risk areas, as well as the UNGPs and ILO standards. It's important as well that they identify smelters or refiners in their supply chains and assess whether they conduct human rights due diligence. And so this is to ensure that there is traceability and human rights risk assessment, and if supplier relationships reflect the aforementioned international standards. Looking more towards the sort of upstream lens, so here it's really important to set expectations around tracing back to mining sites. So sort of going back to Fabrice's points in terms of ensuring that traceability, which is it's sort of easy to say, but in practice it is a lot more sort of complicated to carry out. Thinking of that as well, it's important to think about the circumstances of extraction, trade, and handling and export of the mineral, as well as ensuring that smelters and refiners have a chain of custody or traceability system. So using the OECD due diligence guidance, has the company assessed what minerals are sourced from small and artisanal mines? And where have they engaged with traders or leveraged suppliers to identify origins of minerals? And just a final point around sort of building leverage. Companies do not always have sufficient leverage on their own to change practices at supplier level. And so companies often have the same suppliers as their peers, which means that combining resources to monitor suppliers and build their capacity can help save costs and increase efficiency through joint standards. So engaging with peers can also help less advanced companies to gain practical insights into sort of how to get started. So this is sort of, in response to what Abigail was saying, but sort of deeper dive into that due diligence perspective, and hopefully that can help with sort of meeting these upcoming regulatory requirements.
Thank you. Maybe Jeanette and then Fabrice, I will ask to the two of you and kind of expand a little bit the question on role of investors in articulation with the role of other stakeholders would be part of my question. And to which extent you think that the role of investors can actually gain in leverage with support, building on Remy's point on kind of some collaborative effort or alignment across, for example, what developers or producers can do together, mutualizing efforts instead of just working on their own. It might be a kind of a way to where the role, the investor definitely still has a role, but about engagement, about asking for enforcement, and many other things. So maybe Jeanette first, role of investors, maybe in articulation with stakeholders.
Well, because I would say that we have almost a consumer position in this scheme, because we don't define necessarily the needs of the authorities for a specific project. We can of course support them, but the authorities will define a project, and then we will bid in a competition type process and then make sure that we propose a project that is aligned with, again, all the best practices. So it's a consumer position. And that gives us, of course, an economic lever to push the market to be better if we put in all our requirements with all our with the supply chain in general, that you know the components, the products must comply with specific requirements. Now, what we can do, because I mean this economic lever is as its limit, because again you're in competition, and I'm sorry to say, but for most public tender calls, there's a good chance that the market will be, or the bid will be given to the lowest bidder. So what we think should be done is for the authorities to be more demanding. You know, technology wise, we can do the work. The components and the products exist on the market. It's a question of making sure that that from now on you don't sponsor any other way of doing things, but a responsible one. And this is quite important for us because, you know, we may, and again, we'll see it maybe later, but, in some cases, we decide not to go for a specific project because it's not for us. It does not align with how we want to do things. And we don't feel that we can, be a good competitor in that specific market. So it has its limit when you only talk about the economic lever that you can have. And we think that what we do in terms of stewardship on all the different on all the different forums, because Mirizem is quite involved in sustainable and responsible investment for infrastructure, we make sure to always bring up these issues and put them at the heart of the discussions in order for to have consensus over or around all these issues, and that it will be heard by those who support countries, especially in developing countries where they will be supported by institutional organization, financial organization, but also in OECD countries, for instance, where you have the authorities that have a certain power to kind of make things evolve. And we are ready for it. So again, it's a, I'm coming back to challenges. This is, I'm presenting it as a challenge, but I think it's also our role to be responsible, to be true with our mission and with our commitments, and as well to be in discussion with the authorities, with the people who will launch all these projects, so that they are more ambitious regarding human rights risks.
Yeah. The question is, and maybe that will help Fabrice to get into the discussion. Question is often, and because Fabrice, you're working a lot with public buyers, I would kind of connect the dot here with one point. Last year, we released actually a white paper produced with the construction industry, European construction industry, engaging broadly a lot of multilateral institutions to advance human rights across decisions for investment. So we can spend time in DC, Washington DC, with the World Bank, with the Inter-American Development Bank, presenting and extensively exchanging on that. And ultimately, of course, there is interest and willingness from those multilateral buyers to take that type of stakeholders into account to advance and ensure that public money ultimately is better invested in respect of advancing climate and human rights. So that's where I connect the dots with your point, Fabrice, and your some of your core stakeholder being public buyers. A challenge though is how to make sure that this is as objective as possible, knowing that ultimately it's sometimes difficult to kind of screen and make sure that there is an objective criteria to ensure that there is or there is no risk of soft data, I might say, compared to environmental data, the like human rights. So, I mean, how would you view those aspects with working particularly with public buyers? And of course, other comments on the role of investors is welcome. But
of course, the risk assessment differs very much from one country to another and one mineral from another. If we take the case of tin in Bolivia, for example, the tin is extracted in Bolivia and the two smelters are in Bolivia and then it transports to Europe. So not difficult. You can bring the supply chain players, actors together and have a discussion. And there, of course, investors have a role to play, keeping in mind that if due diligence is seen as a cost for many, of course, it's not a cost. So due diligence, it's an investment. So please, investors, invest in due diligence. That's that what I would say. If we are in DRC, the situation is very different. There are no smelters. I think they don't even have the energy capacity to have smelters in DRC. That's the big issue. But here, the miners, they don't have access to credit. So how can they invest in the mines? If the financial institutions don't bring money, okay? If you go to an artisanal mining site, you have between 5,000 and 20,000 Congolese workers. In the middle, you have one guy who usually is Chinese, sometimes Lebanese, who buys. And this guy, he has the potential to replace the financial institutions by bringing big machine to move the earth, 30 meters of earth, so that the miners, instead of making tunnels, they can access the cobalt directly without risking their life, at least not so much. They do still risk it. But so the Chinese man with his little enterprise there is doing the job of the banks. He's financing the uncover of the minerals so that extraction can take place. So there is a big problem here. Okay, it's weird that this is artisanal finance, if you want, and of course he's getting his money back from the miners by paying them a low rate from what they extracted. I think that the biggest investment that has to be done is the professionalization of miners. You cannot move mines around like you do with the industry. The mines are where the minerals are. That's it. So you need to invest there. And this professionalization is key, because if you invest in miners, in new skills, in new tools, in engineers, then of course you have many, many less accidents and death. That's really extremely important.
We're moving to the last part of our discussion for today, which I think shall maintain strong attention of our participants. Having said all those different perspectives and challenges, and actually your points are interesting to actually also share different perspectives on the different types of investors having to play a different type of role, what in your views can be some of the still for our participants, some of the good practices out there? So we kicked off some of the discussion sharing a toolkit. It's one guidance that is produced obviously aligned in consistency with the OECD standards, which is helpful because a lot of regulations are asking for that. But there are many other interesting initiatives or tools that can be brought to the attention of our participants. And maybe Abigail, I would start with you, because SEIA has developed a series actually of tools on traceability and pledges, building alignment and that type of thing. So maybe a word about them if they can be accessible.
Absolutely. So we have done a series of steps kind of with escalating escalating requirements is probably a fair way to say it. So a couple of years ago, when the industry first really grappled with the idea of forced labor in our supply chain, right after the US government put out a warning and there was some testimony on Capitol Hill about it, we gathered our industry together and said, this is absolutely unacceptable. We have to move quickly. And so we did a couple of things. The first is that we put out a pledge that our companies were committed to not buying products that had forced labor in them and that they would be reevaluating their supply chains. And so that was step one. That was almost 400 companies signed that in a really quick manner. And then we created a traceability protocol. So it was a number of steps that companies could undertake to do that look. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, not only were investors not totally clear about everything in their supply chain, some of the customers or the developers were not totally clear as well. And so this traceability protocol, which is entirely voluntary, gave them some specific steps that they could follow. As I mentioned at the beginning, when the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act passed, there was basically just a stoppage of panels at our borders. Not every company was the subject of investigation, but enough that it had a really significant impact on the industry. And so we wanted to make sure that, number one, there was no forced labor products coming in, and number two, that there was a reliable sort of anticipated, like, standardized practice for proving traceability. And so we became an ANSI certified organization. ANSI is the American National Standards Institute. So as a trade association, that's what we are. As a representative of companies, we are developing a standard so that companies can abide by this standard and have a lot more understanding of their supply chain. I think the part that's really critical when you're talking about kind of policy plus business, we are working with Customs and Border Protection here in the United States, which is the entity that enforces all of our trade laws, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act, all of those things. And so making sure that the United States government is comfortable with the standard that we're promulgating, so that when companies adopt this standard, not only is it helpful for their investors, but it's helpful for ensuring that product gets into the United States relatively smoothly. That obviously, kind of as we think about risk and competitiveness and all those things, that that is important, right, for investors to have that kind of certainty that product will get in. Nobody wants to be investing in products where the solar modules are sitting, you know, in the ocean or stockpiled at the port. So that is the most tangible thing that we have done. It has been obviously a multi-year project. I wish I could snap my fingers and say, you know, not only have we built a domestic manufacturing base here in the United States, but we have gotten a bright light on our entire supply chain overnight. However, that's not reality, right? So there has been a progression of activities that we've done, really engaging companies, but also government. That has been such a critical piece of the puzzle, because they ultimately, at least here, have the final say about whether products can come into the United States. I'm excited after this to sort of combine the toolkit and our standard and see. I'm sure there's a ton of overlap there, which will be helpful. I know we've had initial conversations with some of our European counterparts about sharing this standard and trying to build kind of a larger system, a larger ecosystem, so that companies have more predictability across markets and not kind of separate processes in every market, but more to come on all that.
Just for clarity for our audience, what is accessible and available now and not for anyone willing to browse your website? Or maybe you can just put a link on the chat.
Yep, I will absolutely put a link in the chat. There's two things. One is the traceability protocol, which is what the standard will be based on. That's on our website. And then the other is a much larger solar commitment, which is not only forced labor, but sort of an entire entire suite of ESG steps that companies can take, and with some, you know, practical advice on how to do it, not just go do these and, you know, Godspeed.
Yeah.
I will put the website on the chat.
Yeah, good practice, because so it reflects a sense on understanding business perspective in coordination with authorities to define what good might look like in a way. Remy, maybe some additional or other good practices you think are helpful to share with our participants today?
Sure, definitely. And I think something to point to is sort of multi-stakeholder initiatives in this space. And what comes to mind is Finance Against Slavery and Trafficking Initiative, or FAST. For short, they've provided a sort of blueprint in terms of identification of risks. So some things to consider in terms of risk identification would be high-risk locations and contexts in which businesses or linked businesses operate. So here, thinking really about state involvement in modern slavery or human trafficking. And then also thinking about high-risk labor and recruitment arrangements. So do you have companies that have a heavy reliance on a foreign subsidiary or third-party labor brokers, or is there sort of a higher incident of migrant or refugee labor? Other things to think about include inattention to certification of labor brokers, and then also high level of informalization in the bottom tier of supply chain. And then another area also think of is sort of high risk entities. And so this is thinking of what information you're using to sort of rank companies in terms of their risk levels. So companies and records, media reports, sanction lists, or government registers. And just something to highlight with this is in our own due diligence guidance, we really emphasize the need for stakeholder engagement. So for instance, in areas where it's difficult to access workers, you could go through, say, for instance, the Trade Union Federation or other representative groups of stakeholders, just so that you're getting that information to triangulate what's being reported through benchmarks, as well as what companies are reporting themselves. I think also something to point out around Fabrice's point, just in terms of thinking of the professionalization of mining. Mining's not going anywhere, and it's going to be increasingly needed as we're going through the green transition. So thinking of how do we actually create decent working conditions, and what are the factors that are needed to ensure that we actually don't have risks of forced labor? So provision of a living wage, freedom of association, collective bargaining, ensuring workplace health and safety, social security and social protection, and equal opportunity and treatment. So see, these are sort of some of the drivers as well that can help in terms of that sort of eradication standpoint. And then just to sort of sum up in terms of thinking across that whole risk identification process, just pointing to our peers at the Investor Alliance for Human Rights. So they've recently published guidance looking at the mitigation of Uyghur forced labor risks in renewable energy, in the renewable energy sector, and as well as what are some practical approaches to state-imposed labor in green technologies. So I definitely encourage you to have a look at that guidance as well, just to complement all the tools that are available in terms of how you're approaching forced labor.
Thank you. May I ask you if you can use the chat function to maybe upload a few links, including, by the way, for our audience, the session that is managed or where you contribute on Thursday morning at the event. It's accessible on the chat as well. Maybe Jeanette, a word about some good practices you think are helpful to help you facing and overcoming the challenges that have been discussed today.
Yes, well, as an investor in different assets, we do have, and we had for a while now, a set of procedures and processes for investment, and of course, these these measures are applied from when we identify an investment opportunity until the asset is in portfolio. And you know, we have that asset in our portfolio for, as I mentioned earlier, many, many years. These procedures are to be implemented by the investment teams and the people responsible to monitor and to follow what the assets are doing. And that includes not only, but it does include human rights risks and social issues in general. You know, to make it even more clear, let's say, earlier this year, we have published our human rights policy in order to, let's say, materialize what we have been doing and formally engage with all our assets and, you know, making sure that the commitments of Méridien were clearly defined. Now, this will give way to the development of different tools that, you know, to support the assets in implementing the human rights policy. This work will go on for, you know, for at least a year, and because that will include trainings and again tools and you know, ongoing support. But that starts with the people at Méridien, because that's when we start looking at opportunities. So we have to look at these issues very early on, and I feel like that I'm stating the obvious here by saying that in order to make sure that you address human rights risks appropriately, you have to start as early as possible. And it also includes that you'll be ready to drop an opportunity if it doesn't comply with your commitments. And this is a very, you know, difficult decision to make sometimes, because we think that the project is really useful, justified, that it will bring a lot of benefits in terms of energy transition, for instance. But if it doesn't tick all the boxes in terms of human rights risks, then, you know, in the end, it will not be a good project. And you have to put that you know, clearly in writings and all your documents, and making sure that, you know, all the teams will understand what your mission is, you know, it looks like, and what your commitments are. And it is sometimes very tempting, because again, there's not always a lot of you know, alternatives. So it is, you know, kind of an ongoing work that we do. And very early on now, you know, when we meet with an investment team presenting an opportunity, the question will be asked, so can we ensure that the entire supply chain is, you know, we can manage it and manage it according to our, you know, commitments. And I say, you know, the entire supply chain, because for us, we also have construction sites that we will be involved in. We have the procurement, of course, of all the different materials and components. But we have, you know, sometimes a very long supply chain. So what we do is look at the entire value chain very early on in the process. And for that, if we have to, we'll reach out to, you know, external experts to make sure that we undertake the right due diligences very early on in the process. So it's added work, but it's important work, because, you know, it ensures a real alignment with everything that we stand for.
Yeah, and as you said at the beginning, sort of luckily that's important because you're also looking at long-term engagement. Therefore, obviously, the earlier you flag risks and can be mitigated, the better for those type of long-term positions.
True.
And Fabrice, I'm transitioning to you. And Christelle, because of we will be running out of time, you will have the closing word in a way, instead of our panel, because you have not shared so much of your perspectives. Fabrice, what would be your point there in terms of best practices? And maybe just a comment, which I find important in this conversation, is to find the right balance between there is a lot on due diligence and identification of risks, a lot on traceability. And you seem, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but to emphasize actually also on corrective measure, I would say on the ground asset level, because in ecology, at least there is a proverb that says, you know, the best waste is the waste you don't produce. So to some extent, there could be a parallel here.
So thanks very much. Exactly what I wanted to say, corrective plans, that's interesting. Social audit, it's interesting. But I think it's if you really want to avoid being involved into forced labor, you'd rather get in touch with local partners that do local investigation. And I'm thinking, of course, of trade unions, where trade unions exist. That's not always the case. And to work as representatives and NGOs who are close to the floor, to the field. I think one key issue is there in the factory or in the mine, is there a kind of health and safety committee? If you don't have workers' representatives who can express their concerns, ask for remediation, then there is no dialogue at the workplace. Therefore, everything is open for forced labor. And that's a critical matter. And this concerns also migrant workers, you know, in the factories in Southeast Asia. There are millions and millions of Indonesian people from Myanmar, Burmese, who are moving around across countries. They don't speak the language, the trade unions cannot organize them, they can't even speak together. But at some stage, you know, there are NGOs, they have the capacities themselves to organize and to defend their rights. That's the only condition, I think, to avoid forced labor. Respect labor law and freedom of association, that's the basics.
Thank you. There is a feedback survey that is accessible, and people are welcome to respond. Just takes 10 seconds maximum. Maybe given that we might run out of time, our panelists had extensive time to share their views. Kristen, you will actually be on the floor maybe for a closing word on what maybe you would like to add to what has been shared by other panelists.
Thank you. I mean, I've read so much on this topic since last year. I follow this topic still, and I still find myself learning every time we're in a discussion. I'm like, I'm taking notes. So it's crazy how it's still a learning process even for me. So thank you very much for the panelists for this very insightful conversation. I guess in conclusion, I would say go back to the UNGPs when it comes to how, because we've talked about many challenges on many perspectives that would fit differently with the different actors in the supply chain. So I would say go back to your thinking board, map your supply chains, conduct your human rights due diligence, go on the ground. Fabrice keeps mentioned that repeatedly, the importance of seeing things on the ground, the importance of legislation, as Jeanette was saying, to level the playing field. So Remy spoke about the importance of investors and like backing all of these processes as well. It's important for Abby to note also that, yes, the importance of IRA in legislation and its impact on the US, but it's important also to turn into the US and make sure that there isn't forced labor now in what is being produced within US grounds. So it's important to go back to the initial process of setting a strategy. How do we tackle forced labor in the supply chain? And then each player needs to play its role. And in order to identify this role, we need to go back and do a saliency assessment, an impact assessment, go on the ground, etc., do stakeholder engagement specifically with those impacted, and then come up with an action plan. I think this would be my concluded remark, really.
Thank you. As we are running to the end of the session, I just want to close with a few comments for our participants. First, in fact, I got several messages that were not necessarily shared to everyone, but they were factored across the way I moderated the discussion. So people have shared views, and I'm hopeful that panelists provided responses accordingly. It's been basically a dense discussion with basically a lot that has been shared. So the session will obviously be recorded and uploaded on the OECD side partner session website somehow, and or on the xapa.org website if some of those sources are helpful for you to kind of make sure to capture all that will have been shared. To keep in connection with us at Xapa, feel free to register and access our free monthly newsletter. Join a community that is ensures that you keep up to abreast with some of the trends that we can see. And obviously, related to the topic today and others, and notably on human rights, we have a great number of resources that are accessible on the website. On our publication section. It is time to close the session to thank every panelist for a useful and contribution. We hope that you learned from others as much as we did. And it's time for me to close the session, and for some of you who will be attending the OECD forum these days, you'll get a chance to meet with at least Fabrice and Christelle, to the best of my knowledge, and or PRI colleagues of Remy on Thursday morning. If you want to engage with Jeanette or Abigail, you need to find another way.
LinkedIn.
And I will close the session here. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.